Hear this, old men. Listen, all those who have settled on the land. Has such a thing ever happened in your day? Or did it happen in the days of your forefathers? That was Joel chapter 1, verse 2. Something to think about, little children, as we begin reading further in this book is we will be reading the answer to this question. And that translation of Joel chapter 1 verse 2 was from the Ward Green version of 2003, our daily scripture for this day, December 4th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1911 hours, Canadian Eastern Time. And once again, resuming our study of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, the article from 2011, we begin reading today chapter 8, paragraph 9, and at the left we see a very simple illustration of the Yellow Emperor from the year 151 of the Common Era, only about 151 years after the turn of the Common Era. So, quite a long time ago. It's 81 years after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 CE. This is a mural painting from the Han Dynasty from the source Li Ongbin, Outlines of Chinese History, Shanghai, 1914. And the inscription is translated, quote, "The Yellow Emperor created and changed a great many things. He invented weapons and the wells and fields system. He devised upper and lower garments and established palaces and houses." End quote. And that was a reproduction from Wikipedia, Geschiedenis Vivenchina, which is probably, sounds, it's Dutch. The Dutch Wikipedia, it sounds like. Shaodian is said to be the father in the Chinese mythology of the Yellow Emperor, and it is an expression which translates as, quote, unquote, little law. Compared with Shila, the father of Heber, whose name means sprout or flame, and whose root is similar to the Hebrew word for peace, shalom, it is a fit, little law. A sprout typically is something fairly small. A flame is fairly small, I suppose. And a flame burns. It sort of acts as a law of its own, or it's, I suppose you could say, and that's similar to a sprout because it happens without any human explanation how some plant sprouts. It has a law, or it is a law unto itself. But also we see the Hebrew word for peace, which is shalom, is similar to Shila, who was the father of Heber, his name being Shila, and resembling shalom, which might have something to do with, therefore, peace, because the names are similar, the words are similar. If there's little law, then that would be because there was peace, right? In a country, for example, if we had no need for law, we would assume that was because we had a peaceful society. And whose root, which is the root of Shila, is similar to the word for peace, shalom. So it's a fit. There are many such things found in the Chinese mythology. The Yellow Emperor, who we said was Heber, had as a son, Shao Hao, who was also called Xuan Shao, Xuan Shao, whom we have called Joktan, the son of Eber, may be translated as, quote, mysterious clamor, unquote. Xuan Shao, mysterious clamor, or Joktan. It is said that the Yellow Emperor had 25 sons, all born of his four wives, Lei Tzu, Fang Lei, Tong Yu, I don't know how to pronounce these, and Mo Mu. 14 sons began their own surnames or clans. Also, in addition to those four wives who had those given names, the Yellow Emperor had 14 sons who began their own surnames or clans. As a boy with roots in Hans Harbor, Newfoundland, I find great beauty and simplicity in the story of the Han people. Compare with Hans, who, according to Wikipedia, are of the Huaxia Chinese group, a name meaning splendid, in quote, splendid summer, end quote. In the narrow original sense, Huaxia refers to a group or confederation of tribes of ancient people living along the Yellow River who formed the nucleus of what later became the Han ethnic group in China. Freely speaking, it is undeniable that the name Shinar has within itself the very essence of the name of China, while even the Chinese language comes under the name of Sinitic. There's undoubtedly a poetic simplicity in the idea that before coming to China, Heber was on the plains of Shinar, and that his grandfather Kainan and his father Shelah, who had also lived in Shinar, then founded the Chinese nation. The bloodline of Nimrod is not forgotten either, as Azirad, the daughter of Nimrod, or Nimrod, married Heber according to tradition, so they were Hebrews and descended from Nimrod, the Septuagint name for Nimrod. Even the similarity of the name of Nimrod to Hebrew reminds us of this. So that, in fact, that's the end, by the way, of that paragraph, chapter 8, paragraph 9, in the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. But isn't that something? I'm realizing it even more just this moment as I speak, that might well explain how the Hebrews got their name. Why they're called Hebrews is because there was a Yellow Emperor called, in Hebrew, Heber, who married a daughter of Nimrod, and so the similarity of the name of the two names, Nimrod and Hebrew, is another reason why that name Hebrew would be chosen, perhaps, for the whole tribe of all the sons of Heber, including those who lived in China, but also those who lived in... This is fascinating because... Wait a minute. Because some of the sons, or at least one of the sons of Heber, remained in Shinar. And that's how we have the line of Heber, which led to the patriarch Abraham, and that lineage that became so prominent in the Bible, but it was prominent for a reason, that the promises given to Abraham continued on throughout the Bible account, and they were the progeny of Abraham continued in the Bible account to be recorded in the Bible for us as a way to trace the history completely through that lineage. So that lineage of Abraham was critical, but also came from the line of Hebrew, so they're all Hebrews, even those in China, but just whether the ones who remained in Shinar were from the same wife, we have to check that in the book of Jubilees. Have we got that here? Let's see. That's it there. Look at that. It's in the book of Jubilees, is it? Is it in the book of Jubilees, or is it in... I'm trying to think. It's in the book of Jubilees, yeah. Right. Eber was the son of Shelah, right. Look at this. It even, in Jubilees, chapter 8, I believe it is. Yeah, chapter 8, verse 5, it even says that one of the wives, at least, if there were more than one, but one of the wives of, who is it we're talking about? Kainan. Right. Kainam, as he's called here, in verse 1. And then jumping down to verse 5, he took a wife named Melka, who was the daughter of Madai, the son of Japheth. So he took one of the daughters of Japheth as a wife. And we're speaking about Kainam, or Kainan, as he's variously called. And so he was, so that lineage that was also from Japheth, the lineage from which came the son Shelah, as the beginning of that lineage. And then Shelah took his father's niece, who was called Muach, as a wife. We're just ignoring the timeline there because we don't think the timeline has anything. It doesn't bear on anything that is corroborated by the other ancient historians or anything else that we know about. But she bare him a son in the fifth year, and therefore he called his son Eber. And he took the wife Azurad, as we just mentioned, who was the daughter of Nebrod. And once again, we're ignoring the chronology, but then Peleg was born to Eber, right? And then it says, in the days when he was born, the children of Noah began to divide the earth amongst themselves. And we dated that event to 2741. And I've been thinking about this, trying to correlate these things. 27, we said, 74 was the eclipse of Nimrod. 27 years later would be the death of Osiris if he was ruling beginning in that year and ruled for 27 years, which is one of the interpretations of the myth about Osiris and how he died in his 28th year. So 2747 would be that death of Osiris. And if after the death of Osiris, if that had been the time of 6 years of the rule of Nimrod at that point, before the dividing of the earth, and they gradually left off building the tower, but it could have been that they started the division of the earth in 2741, which is what we decided later. And the reason why I say that is because it was said, in fact, that could have been when they began to build the tower. Because remember, in the Bible account, it says that they built the tower, or began to build the tower, because they were afraid that they would be scattered throughout the earth. So the fact that maybe they had already begun dividing the earth, we don't know all these things. Not yet. So in 2741, if that was the beginning of the Tower of Babel, then the 42 years that the Tower of Babel was, you know, all told, undertaken until 2699, which was the beginning of the rule of the Yellow Emperor. Then we only have to explain the 14 years from 2699 to 2685, which is Old Kingdom Egypt, according to recent accounts from Wikipedia as the beginning of Old Kingdom Egypt, if they're right, the 2685. But maybe we can account for that 14 years beginning in 2699 by taking that 14 years as the rule of the 6 years of, as it was called, I'm trying to think, Enmerkar, or Evecharis, or whoever it is. Maybe, let me suppose here, let's see. Is it possible that maybe the Tower of Babel wasn't included in that? What's 42 plus 12? 54. Doesn't quite work. 54 and 7 is 61. It almost makes up the 62 years of Menes, or as accounted in at least one of the accounts of Manetho for the rule of Menes. And it's, as I recall, 62 is one of the accounts, isn't it? 62 plus what? I can't remember without looking it up. We'll have to look it up, I guess. You have to keep looking these things up if you want to make progress. Otherwise, you don't, if you don't want to make progress. But if you want to make progress, you have to keep on cross-checking and... Now, that's not the account. It's this one I want. Fotheringham. The chronology of the Old Testament. And we're scrolling back. We're just about there now. There it is, Dynasty 1. 62 years for Menes, according to Africanus in his account of Manetho. Right. But then there's 57 years for Athothis also. 5-year difference, which we can't really yet account for in all of its intricacies, right, of the different accounts. We're getting closer, because the longer we study it, the more we're going to be able to come up with some kind of synergy or, you know, correlate everything in such a way that it perhaps can't be broken. Well, we've used 17 or 18 minutes now in our study, but that's just about it. The thing is, that 14 years that was talked about by Mr. Jackson for the ruler, Nimrod, followed by his successor. Can we find Mr. Jackson? We have Mr. Jackson available? I don't know. Let's see. When did we last look at this? Oh, I can find it. Maybe I can find it. Let's see. Here? I know roughly where it is. Near the end of our list here. Chronology of the Old Testament by... we're close. There we go. Let's see. There it is, Chronology of the Old Testament. Okay, Mr. Jackson, here he is. You just have to go down to the part where he talks about Nimrod. I don't know where it was right now. I can look it up, I think. Do I remember the page number? No. Well, that's the Hebrews he's saying. Okay. So it won't be in that section. I hear it is the Babylonian. Right? The Babylonian section. Or the Chaldean section. Let's just sort of go page up. There's Sanchenathan mentioned. It seems like we're getting close. But I'm not sure. We can also search for Nimrod. Look at this. That was a list of Chaldean kings before the flood. That's in Jackson's book on page 199 of volume 1. Here it is. We got something here. Chaldean kings, right? The Aloris and so on. The reign of them. This is before the deluge, though, so I don't think... Right, so we're going to have to go down below that. So we have to go scrolling back the other way, forward in the book, to find the kings after the deluge. Maybe we can find it. Or I can just search for the name Nimrod. I think we'll just search for the name Nimrod. See what we come up with. Right? So, what page are we on now? That's the preface. That won't be it. Let's see. Here it's coming. Make sure that I get to the end of the page each time. I think we're going to find it shortly. Yes, something interesting there. Let's see. Right. What page are we on now? 276. Yeah, it sounds like, I think it's around page 300 or something, isn't it? Come to think of it. There's 233. Well, it might not be that far, actually. It might be. Here it is. Here's something. We got it here. It's only page 200 and something. Page 233. Right. That's why the number 3 is in there. That I was thinking of 300. So, Nimrod, the first Belus, reigned in Babylon after the dispersions. 6 years. Right? Okay. It's curious, but we don't have to take it exactly as he says. Since we don't exactly know what's meant by the dispersion, perhaps, right? But then, Evecus, 7 years. If the dispersion... See, so this 14 years or 13 years here, 6 and 7, 6 and 7.5, so it's about 14. Add those two rules or reigns up together. 14 years. So if that's counted from 1699, 14 years is exactly the time to the beginning of the new kingdom. Then we'd have to figure out whether or not this king who came after, called Porus, does he fit any of the kings of the new kingdom of Egypt? But, of course, you know, he could have been ruling in Babylon, though, while the Egyptian kingdom was beginning. That's the point. The thing is that Thoth, this Evecharus could be the equivalent of Thoth, right? And Thoth could have been, he was someone who had a part in the destruction of, just thinking about, wait a minute now, in the destruction of Osiris. 57 years. Now, okay, what about if the 57 years of Thoth began with the destruction of Osiris in 2747 minus 57, since we just saw 57 years for Thoth, or Thothis, given by Africanus as his account of Manetho, the second king being a Thothis for 57 years. So 57 taken from 2747 is 2690 would be the end of his rule. Doesn't really jibe perfectly with 2699 because it's a 9-year difference. Doesn't fit any of these rules, does it? Yeah, but we're looking for these kinds of correspondence. We need to keep looking. Now, I can't possibly do all the arithmetic in one day or one month or one year. It just needs to be constantly studied. And then someday, there may be a breakthrough where we suddenly, as did happen in the writing of this article, there was a breakthrough of some kind that caused me to write this article. Or there were many different breakthroughs that caused me to write this article. But when another breakthrough comes, if it's significant, then another article might be written also. But there was some significant breakthrough in this article, certainly, that was more significant than all the others. And it was the fact that we established the Chinese people and their origin as having begun with the descendant in the Bible called Heber, who was a descendant of Noah through the line of Shem, with intermarriage, as we've seen from the Book of Jubilees, with both the lines of Japheth and the line of Ham, or the lines of Japheth and the lines of both Japheth and Ham, to be grammatically correct, right? So, yeah, I mean, so in other words, it's not pure bloodlines where the sons of Shem only intermarried with daughters who were of Shem also. There's intermarriage between the bloodlines, right? Which is what you would expect, what you would hope for, because intermarriage in the modern times, as a consequence of genetic deterioration, of course, over many years, has been forbidden. So that, you know, we can marry our cousins up till recently, anyway. I'm not sure if it's changing. But we were allowed to marry our cousins, but we can't marry our brother if we're a woman, or we can't marry our sister if we're a man, because that's intermarriage, which is genetically not a good thing. So it's preferential to breed with a different blood, a different family or a different bloodline. It's just better because any defect in the genetics will not be carried from both parents into the child and lead to a genetic defect, which could happen if there were intermarriage, right? And so intermarriage is not something that is any more legal or, you know, justifiable based on the genetics, which have deteriorated. And that's completely consistent with what the Bible says about the fact that we were born, that Adam and Eve sinned, and that his sons and daughters were born sinful because they inherited sin. In other words, it was genetic. That's exactly what the Bible has told us all along. So or crossbreeding is better in the human family, which is what was done even by the sons of Noah and their descendants already. They were or crossbreeding. They weren't marrying in their own close families. They weren't interbreeding, because very close interbreeding is not as good, you know. But as we know, much later in time, although I don't think at that time it was necessarily forbidden, we don't get that from the ancient sources. So it may not have been forbidden at that time that they married a sister. Wait a minute. At the time of Noah, though, much later. I mean, excuse me, Moses. If at the time of Moses, we get in the book of Moses, right? Let's look at the book of Moses. Let's try and look for this. Mary. And the word sister. Can we find that? No, can't. Okay, let's see. The daughter. Let's see. Father, daughter, father, daughter, father. Trying to think of where I'd find it. the daughter of your father. Right. You must not lay bare their nakedness, the daughter of your father. So yeah, it looks like in the Bible at Leviticus 18:9 that the nakedness of your sister you are not to lay bare. So therefore that's probably because of the problem of interbreeding at the time, even of Moses. It looks like could have been the case. And the daughter of your father's wife, the daughter of your father's wife, the offspring of your father. Was also forbidden, precluded. Any blood relation of your father, in other words, you see that? Verse 12, was forbidden to lay bare their nakedness, which appears to be a way of saying there's a danger of interbreeding there. That's what it appears to be saying. And interbreeding is the thing, perhaps, that was the reason, although it doesn't say that. And it was more than just that, too. It was not just the interbreeding. It was something to do with it being inappropriate, or it just was forbidden, regardless of whether there was any procreation. The nakedness of your father's brother, your aunt, you were not allowed to lay her nakedness bare. Right? So it was true of the aunt too, but the cousin was still okay, right? It doesn't mention the cousin. If you look through this, and that's how we sort of get our own laws today, from the time of Moses, but back, way back at the time of Shem and his immediate descendants, we don't see those laws. We don't know. But we're just about finished for today, so let's wrap it up now. Our study today is from the article, The Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, Chapter 8, Paragraph 9, which we covered. And the date is December 4th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1943 hours, Canadian Eastern Time. Thank you so much for listening and watching once again. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. The moon should be starting to be visible, I think. In the moon, it is. We're on lunar day, what? I don't know. Let's see if I can find out what lunar day we're on. Lunar day four. So I can see the moon on my watch, on my moon phase watch here on Star, because the moon is now visible on day four, quite clearly visible. So I've got my moon watch set approximately correctly, but that's all for today. Wasn't that fascinating? And see you again soon, hopefully.